Have you ever watched a system, maybe a massive project at work, or an organization you belong to, or, even your own physical health look completely stable, like perfectly fine on paper, right up until the exact moment it catastrophically fails?
Oh, absolutely. It's that feeling where everything looks green and then boom.
Right, exactly. You're looking at the weekly reports, all the metrics are giving you the thumbs up, and then out of nowhere, the whole thing just collapses. It leaves you feeling, I don't know, entirely betrayed by your own instruments.
Yeah, that betrayal is a really universal experience, whether you're managing a global supply chain or just, trying to manage your own stress levels on a Tuesday.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because today, in this deep dive, we're exploring an idea that proves that system didn't just snap out of nowhere. It was dying for months.
Right, the failure was happening right in front of you.
Yes, and the dashboards you relied on were actively lying to you about it. We're looking at this fascinating document called The Practice of Coherence: Navigation, Participation, and Prevention in Complex Systems.
Authored by Bechara Sahili with some analytical contributions from AI, yeah.
Exactly. And our mission today is to figure out exactly why those dashboards lie, how to spot the invisible warning signs of collapse, and why our human instinct to jump in and fix things actually makes it worse.
Right, because we have this deep-seated assumption built into every model we use, right? Whether it's medicine, engineering, economics, we assume that if something goes wrong, a measurement will spike.
A dial will turn red.
Exactly. The warning lights will flash in time for us to do something. But the core revelation of this document is that complex systems do not fail abruptly.
They drift.
Yes, they drift toward failure through a progressive, invisible degradation of what the author calls relational coherence. So to understand failure, we have to stop looking at isolated variables.
Right, and start looking at the hidden structure beneath them.
Yeah.
So let's start with the tools we use every single day. If systems are drifting into failure long before the actual collapse, why don't our metrics catch it?
Well, the author identifies this as the dashboard problem. Think about what a dashboard actually measures.
Like my Apple Watch or the KPI spreadsheet.
Yeah, or a patient's vital signs in an ICU, or a nation's GDP. Dashboards only show lagging state variables. They tell you what is happening at the very surface of the system at this exact second.
Okay, so they measure the output.
Exactly.
So if I'm looking at a dashboard that says my project is on budget and on time, I'm really just looking at the exhaust pipe of the car, not the engine itself.
The exhaust pipe is a great way to think about it because by the time a dashboard turns red, by the time the state variables go out of bounds, the system has already lost its underlying structural coherence.
The damage is already done.
Right. The architecture holding it together has already fractured. When that dial hits the red zone, you are no longer preventing a crisis.
You're just managing the symptoms.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Dashboards display what is easily quantifiable, not what is structurally vital.
Which brings us to the alternative the author proposes,
Oh.
which is called the altimeter. And the altimeter doesn't track state variables at all, right?
No, it tracks structural drift. It's looking for those subtle underlying patterns that show the system is quietly losing its grip on reality.
Okay, the text breaks down four specific early warning signals that this altimeter measures. Let's really dig into the mechanics of these. The first one is path dependence. How exactly does a system show path dependence?
So path dependence reveals itself when the underlying responsiveness of a system fundamentally shifts, meaning the same exact input you've always used suddenly starts producing a completely different outcome.
Wait, like building a tolerance.
Yes, exactly like that. If you have a patient, and you administer a specific dose of a medication that usually lowers their heart rate by 10 beats per minute, but today that same dose only lowers it by 2 beats per minute, that is path dependence.
Wow. But the surface metric, their heart rate might still technically be within a normal range on the dashboard, right?
Precisely. The dashboard is green, but the relationship between the input and the output has drifted. The structure has changed.
I can see that in a mechanical system too.
Yeah.
Like if I apply the same amount of physical load to a bridge, but the structural deflection is slightly different than it was a year ago. The bridge isn't broken yet, but it's responding differently.
Exactly. It's a fundamental shift in behavior.
Okay, the second signal is cross-channel divergence. This sounds like subsystems falling out of alignment.
Yeah. Divergence is when the internal coordination of the system begins to fracture. Complex systems maintain themselves by keeping various subsystems synchronized.
Right.
So in a healthy state, these channels move together. In a deteriorating state, they decouple. Taking a clinical example, a patient's blood pressure might look perfectly stable on the monitor.
Dashboard is green.
The dashboard is green, but if you look at their blood labs, their lactate levels are steadily rising.
And lactate rises when cells aren't getting enough oxygen.
Right. So the macrosystem, the blood pressure, is masking a microfailure at the cellular level. That underlying tension is divergence. The system is fighting itself to maintain the illusion of stability on the surface.
That is so creepy to think about.
Yeah.
Okay, that the third altimeter signal is increasing variability. This is when you start seeing, like, rising erratic fluctuations in the system's behavior.
Yeah.
The needle starts shaking.
Yeah, the shaking is key.
But I want to understand the why behind that shaking. Like, if a system is breaking down, shouldn't it just slowly grind to a halt? Why does it become more variable?
Well, think of a tightrope walker. When a highly skilled tightrope walker is perfectly balanced, their body is almost entirely still. They are in a state of deep coherence.
Okay.
But if a gust of wind hits them and they start to lose their center of gravity, what happens?
Their arms start flailing.
Exactly. Their arms are flailing, their legs wobble, they're burning massive amounts of physical and kinetic energy, just throwing their weight from side to side just to avoid falling off the rope.
Oh, wow. So that flailing is the variability.
Yeah. Yes. When a complex system exhibits increasing variability, it means its buffering capacity is declining. It's struggling to maintain its equilibrium, and it has to work harder and harder, oscillating wildly just to stay upright.
That makes total sense. The flailing is literally a symptom of exhaustion. And the fourth signal ties right into that delayed recovery.
Right.
It simply takes longer for the system to return to its baseline after a shock. If that tightrope walker almost falls, it takes them 5 full minutes to catch their breath and steady their legs, whereas before, they could recover in 10 seconds.
Delayed recovery is the purest measure of eroding resilience. A healthy system snaps back like a fresh rubber band. A degrading system stretches out, and the snapback is, you know, slow, sluggish, and incomplete. The elasticity is gone.
I keep thinking about the experience of driving an older car. The dashboard tells you you're going 60 miles per hour. The engine temperature is right in the middle. The gas tank is full.
Everything looks fine.
Right. If you only look at the dashboard, you feel completely safe. But the altimeter is like the seasoned mechanic sitting in the passenger seat.
Yeah.
They aren't looking at the speedometer. They're feeling the slight hesitation in the steering column.
They're listening to the tiny high-pitched whine of the transmission slipping.
Exactly. The dashboard says stable, but the altimeter says, your transmission is going to drop out in 3 miles.
The mechanic is sensing the erosion of margin. And margin is a central concept we really need to understand here.
Let's define that. What is margin?
Margin is the reserve capacity a system possesses to absorb a disturbance without losing its primary function. Every system needs margin to survive a chaotic world.
Right.
So when you observe those four signals, when the car hesitates, when the gears slip, when the steering shakes, you are watching the system actively burn through its margin just to maintain the illusion of cruising at 60 miles per hour.
But this leads us to a massive, uncomfortable question. If these altimeter signals exist, if the transmission is whining, if the tightrope walker is flailing, if the margin is visibly eroding, why don't the people in charge see it?
It's a great question.
I mean, if a company is burning through cash just to maintain a veneer of profitability, or a patient is quietly dying despite normal blood pressure, why do the experts get blindsided?
Well, we culturally assume that a failure of perception is just a technical limitation. We tell ourselves that, oh, we just didn't have enough data, or the sensors weren't sensitive enough.
We assume the system wants to be fixed.
Exactly. We assume that every system fundamentally wants to be seen clearly. But the text introduces a much darker reality about the anatomy of complex systems. The system is not always trying to see itself clearly.
Wait, really?
Yeah. Under stress, a system will actively organize itself to avoid seeing the truth.
Okay, the document draws this incredible distinction between noise and silence. I always thought of them as the same thing, just a lack of clear information.
Yeah, most people do.
But they're fundamentally opposed. Noise is when the signal is present, but it's obscured by static. It's hard to read. Silence, however, is the absence of permission to recognize a signal.
That's a crucial distinction. Noise degrades clarity. Silence alters reality entirely. In a noisy environment, the system is trying to interpret the data but struggling. In a silent environment, the system has reorganized itself to ensure the data is never interpreted in the first place.
Wow.
The author categorizes this refusal to see into three distinct modes of perceptual failure. The first mode is capacity failure. This is the easiest one to grasp.
This is just lacking the sensor, right?
Yeah. The system literally cannot see the problem because it lacks the physical or structural sensors. You don't have the right monitoring equipment installed, so the signal passes by undetected. This is basically an engineering problem. You solve it by installing a better sensor.
But the second mode is where human psychology starts creeping in, interpretive failure. The system sees the signal, the sensor works, the data is sitting right there on the desk. But the system misreads it or actively normalizes it.
Normalization of deviance is a powerful, powerful force. You see that increasing variability we talked about, the flailing tightrope walker. But the manager reviewing the data shrugs and says, well, that's just normal seasonal fluctuation. The market is just volatile right now.
They write it off.
Exactly. The system protects its own internal narrative not by solving the underlying structural decay, but by reinterpreting the warning signal as benign. It neutralizes the threat conceptually so it doesn't have to deal with it operationally.
I can think of a dozen corporate examples of this. Like, the quality assurance team runs a test on a new software release the day before launch, and it is full of critical bugs.
A blaring altimeter signal.
Huge signal.
Yeah.
But because the marketing campaign has already been paid for and the CEO promised the board a launch, the project manager reclassifies those critical bugs as minor user interface glitches to be patched post-launch. That's interpretive failure driven by pressure.
And that scenario bleeds directly into the third and most dangerous mode of perceptual failure, which is suppression. In a state of suppression, the signal is detected, it is accurately interpreted, and it is fully recognized as an existential threat.
But they ignore it.
Worse. The system actively, consciously buries it because the cost of acknowledging the signal is deemed too high.
Wait, if the signal means the system might collapse, how could the cost of acknowledging it be higher than the cost of collapse? That sounds completely irrational.
What's fascinating here is that it sounds irrational if you view the system as a single unified entity with long-term survival as its only goal. But complex systems are made of interacting roles, incentives, and human beings with immediate needs.
Oh, I see.
Suppression is an evolutionary adaptation. Systems suppress signals to preserve their short-term coherence, even if it guarantees their long-term destruction.
Because acknowledging a systemic failure might trigger massive political fallout or immediate economic ruin or, you know, the firing of the leadership team.
Exactly. So the system instinctively shifts its resources away from managing reality and toward managing the perception of reality.
The text calls this the distortion field. And it breaks this field down into very specific classes of distortion. There's sensory distortion, which is just the failure to detect.
Right.
Interpretive distortion, where you misclassify the threat. Temporal distortion, which is fascinating. It's when the system intentionally delays the transmission of bad news so that by the time it reaches the decision makers, it's a historical fact rather than an actionable warning.
That happens all the time in large bureaucracies.
Well, for sure. Then there's structural distortion, where the hierarchy of the organization is literally designed to filter out negative feedback before it reaches the top.
Add to that incentive distortion, which is exactly what happened with your software launch example. The incentives heavily penalize delivering bad news and heavily reward maintaining the schedule.
Yeah.
And finally, cognitive distortion, which acknowledges the biological limits of human attention, fatigue, and cognitive bias. When you layer all these distortions together, you get an organization, a body, or an economy that appears completely stable on the surface dashboard, but is actively rotting underneath.
So the system is navigating a hallucination.
It is responding to its own representation of reality rather than reality itself.
Which brings up a really thorny philosophical issue. If the system is constantly distorting the truth and actively filtering out the bad news, who exactly is doing the observing? We use this language all the time in business and science. We talk about observing the system to fix the system. But the author completely dismantles the myth of the external observer.
This represents a radical, necessary shift in how we approach intervention. Since the scientific revolution, we've harbored this deep-seated belief that there exists an Archimedean point, a position entirely outside the system from which it can be observed neutrally, measured objectively, and controlled rationally.
We imagine the doctor or the economic policymaker or the plant manager as standing apart from the machinery, holding a clipboard, turning dials.
But they aren't outside. They are deeply embedded inside the very system they are trying to fix.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Let's go back to our car analogy. It's like being a mechanic, but you aren't standing in a sterile garage looking under the hood. Mm-hmm. You are physically strapped inside the engine block while the car is speeding down the highway at 80 miles an hour. You're trying to tighten a bolt on the alternator, but the engine is 200 degrees. The vibration is blurring your vision. Your muscles are cramping from holding an awkward position. You aren't just fixing the engine. Your own physical exhaustion, your panic, your limited range of motion are directly dictating which bolts you can even reach. You are part of the vibration.
The observer is inextricably bound by the environment they are observing. And because the observer is embedded, observation is never a passive act. It is an act of interaction. The moment you choose to measure a specific metric, you change the system.
Give me an example of how measurement changes the system.
Consider a hospital that implements a strict new dashboard metric requiring all emergency room patients to be seen by a doctor within 15 minutes of arrival. The observer, the hospital administration, has decided this is the most important metric. What happens?
The staff freaks out.
The ER staff, under immense pressure to keep the dashboard green, starts rushing complex triage assessments. They might move a patient out of the waiting room into a hallway bed just to stop the 15-minute clock, even though the patient isn't receiving actual care yet.
Oh, wow.
By choosing to observe and enforce that specific metric, the administration hasn't just neutrally measured the ER. They have fundamentally altered the clinical behavior, often at the expense of unmeasured but critical areas like diagnostic accuracy.
The document lays out 6 specific constraints on this embedded observer. And reading through these was a massive revelation for me. It explained exactly why smart people make terrible decisions in a crisis.
They're incredibly illuminating.
First, there are constraints with a capital C.
Mm-hmm.
The rigid protocols, the legal liabilities, the institutional rules you are forced to follow, regardless of context. Second is margin. Not that the system's margin, but your own personal margin. Your time, your sleep deprivation, your emotional bandwidth. Mm-hmm. Third is disturbance. The acute stress, the noise, the sheer uncertainty you are dealing with in the moment. Fourth is perception limits, your own internal biases, your blind spots, your lack of holistic data.
Fifth is regulation limits, your actual jurisdictional authority. You might see the problem, but lack the power to authorize the fix.
And sixth are your options. What is physically, legally, and realistically possible for you to execute in that exact second?
When you lay out those 6 constraints, you realize that the observer is never free to act purely on what they perceive to be the truth. This leads to what Saheeli defines as self-distortion. The observer distorts their own perception, not out of malice, but as a direct consequence of their constraints.
Like an exhausted physician.
Exactly. A physician operating at the absolute limit of their personal margin might default to a familiar standard diagnosis rather than investigating a subtle altimeter signal, simply because their brain lacks the metabolic energy to engage in complex analytical reasoning at hour 14 of a shift.
Or a mid-level manager, avoiding escalating a critical safety issue because they recognize their regulation limits. They know they lack the institutional capital to fight a battle with the executive board, so they subconsciously downplay the severity of the issue to themselves to alleviate the cognitive dissonance.
So we aren't just dealing with the system that lies to us to protect itself. We are dealing with our own internal psychological and physiological filters that actively prevent us from seeing the lie.
That is terrifying. But the text insists on a practice to counteract this, called observer state mapping. Before you make any decision, before you heroically try to fix the system, you have to map yourself. You have to stop and interrogate your own position in the engine block.
You have to ask, what are my constraints right now? Am I reacting to the data or am I reacting to my own exhaustion? What institutional incentives are secretly driving my interpretation of this dashboard?
Shifting from the illusion of an external controller to the reality of an embedded observer completely changes the definition of success. The goal can no longer be controlling the system from the outside. The goal must shift to participating in the system responsibly.
You have to understand that your interventions are adding load to a structure that is already strained.
But wait. Put yourself in the shoes of a listener who is managing a crisis right now. They're stressed. They're trapped inside a distorted system. Their own perception is compromised by fatigue. And the dashboard they rely on is actively lying to them. How on earth do they make a decision? If you realize you are flying blind, doesn't that just lead to total catastrophic paralysis?
It creates the ultimate decision-making crucible. How do you act when action is required, but certainty is impossible? The text breaks down decision-making under these distorted conditions into 3 distinct failure modes.
Okay, what's the first one?
The first, as you mentioned, is delay. This is the paralysis. You wait for perfect data. You wait for the altimeter signal to become an undeniable dashboard crisis. You want absolute proof before you take the professional risk of acting.
And delay feels incredibly safe in the moment. You can always defend delay by saying, I was gathering more information.
But delay is incredibly expensive. While you are waiting for certainty, the system's underlying margin is silently eroding. The structural decay is accelerating. By the time the dashboard finally flashes red and the problem is undeniable, your options have collapsed.
The interventions required to save the system at that point are massive, right?
Massive, destructive, and often fatal. The second failure mode is the exact opposite of delay. Force. This is when the observer, often driven by panic or institutional pressure, acts aggressively on partial information.
They just slam the hammer down.
They override the system's natural dynamics. They mandate a rigid fix. They cap a price in a market. They flood a patient with aggressive medication. They fire half the staff to cut costs immediately.
I have to push back here. Isn't forcing a fix exactly what leaders are paid to do? When things are spiraling, people want a leader who steps in, takes control, and forces the metrics back into the green zone. If a CEO forces a massive restructuring and the stock price jumps the next day, the world calls that a success.
The world calls it a success because the world only looks at the dashboard. Forcing is incredibly seductive, precisely because it often forces the surface state variables back into the green zone very quickly. The stock price goes up, the blood pressure normalizes.
Oh, man.
But forcing causes profound structural damage. It bypasses the system's internal regulatory mechanisms. It strips away the system's natural adaptability. It is the ultimate illusion of control. You haven't healed the system. You have merely forced it into a rigid posture that will shatter the next time a disturbance hits.
You traded long-term resilience for short-term optics.
Exactly. And then there's the third failure mode, the misaligned decision. This is when you act forcefully, but in the wrong direction entirely, because your perception was distorted by the system's silence. You consume massive amounts of effort and margin, but actually accelerate the structural failure.
So if delaying guarantees failure, forcing destroys the internal structure, and moving in the wrong direction accelerates collapse, What are we supposed to do? Are we just doomed?
We navigate. The author provides a framework called the 5 Principles for Decision Under Distortion. These are the guardrails for navigating this impossible terrain.
Okay, wait them out for us.
Principle 1, act on structure, not variables. Don't wait for the lagging dashboard indicators to give you permission. Act on the altimeter signals, the changing response patterns, the increasing variability. Address the root coherence, not the symptom.
Makes sense.
Principle 2, preserve margin above all else. Before you take any action, ask yourself, does this intervention preserve the system's capacity to adapt, or does it consume it? Principle 3, minimize forcing. Only use blunt force to override the system when delay is absolutely provably more dangerous than the structural damage you are about to cause, and commit to restoring the natural structure immediately after the crisis passes.
Okay, so force is an absolute last resort.
Yes. Principle 4, interrogate apparent stability. If a deeply distorted, highly stressed system suddenly looks perfectly stable on the dashboard, don't trust it. Ask what suppressed signals, what unseen forces are maintaining that illusion.
And the last one.
Principle 5. Act reversibly when possible. Under deep uncertainty, avoid irreversible actions that lock you into a single path and eliminate your future options.
I hear the theory, and structurally it makes perfect sense. But practically, applying those 5 principles in the heat of the moment when your boss is yelling at you or the alarms are blaring seems superhumanly difficult. Even if we make the best possible decisions under distortion, it feels like we are still stuck playing an endless game of whack-a-mole. We are constantly reacting to a system that is always threatening to break down.
You've hit on the core tragedy of modern management. Even when we make good decisions under distortion, we are making them too late. We are entirely caught in a reactive trap.
So how do we escape it?
To truly escape this dynamic, we have to fundamentally redefine what the concept of prevention means. In our current culture, we view prevention merely as reacting slightly earlier to a problem. But true prevention isn't an action you take right before a crash. True prevention is the architecture of the system itself.
That brings us to a really fascinating part of the document, the 5 layers of prevention. It redefines prevention not as a heroic rescue mission, but as a continuous condition of structural coherence that you design and maintain. It's about building systems that don't constantly require exhausted humans to swoop in and save them.
Exactly. Look at our modern technological and bureaucratic systems. They are trapped in an exhausting cycle of detection and forceful intervention. They require a massive, continuous influx of human effort and capital just to stay barely stable.
That isn't resilience.
No, that is maintenance under extreme strain. To map a way out, Saley outlines a prevention gradient, starting from the most fundamental upstream architecture down to the final desperate interventions. Layer one is primordial prevention.
Primordial, like from the very beginning.
Right. This is the highest leverage, lowest effort layer, yet we almost entirely ignore it. Primordial prevention is about shaping the foundational environment, the core incentives, and the basic constraints so that the risk never even has the fertile ground to emerge in the first place.
So primordial prevention in public health wouldn't be building more hospitals. It would be designing cities where it's safe to walk so people naturally to exercise, or regulating the food supply so metabolic disease doesn't develop to begin with. You're changing the water the fish swims in.
Precisely. It is architectural. But if primordial prevention fails or is ignored, risk emerges. That leads us to layer two, primary prevention. This is where you deploy your altimeter. You detect the very early, subtle disturbances, the path dependence, the divergence, before any structural damage has occurred, and you gently guide the system back to coherence.
And if you miss that?
You drop to layer three, secondary prevention. The disturbance is established, the system is actively degrading, and you must intervene early to halt the progression.
And if you fail there, you hit layer four, tertiary prevention. This is what we usually call crisis management. The damage has occurred. The dashboard is red. The system has collapsed, and you are desperately applying force to restore basic function.
Which is incredibly high effort, incredibly high cost, and extremely low leverage.
And that leads us to the layer that represents a true paradigm shift in how we think about intervention. Right. Layer five, quaternary prevention.
Yes.
This concept absolutely blew my mind. Quaternary prevention is the active, deliberate prevention of harmful overintervention.
Yes.
It forces us to confront the reality that our desperate attempts to save the system can become the very thing that destroys it.
Quaternary prevention is profound because it requires immense discipline and humility from the observer. It is the recognition that the cure can be worse than the disease. In clinical medicine, this means protecting the patient from unnecessary aggressive treatments that will only degrade their quality of life. In economics, it means preventing regulators from over-regulating a market shock and inadvertently freezing the entire credit system. It is the active restraint of the human ego that demands we do something.
Sometimes the absolute hardest, most courageous, and best thing you can do for a failing system is to stop trying to fix it.
Yeah.
Step away. Stop over-treating the patient. Stop micromanaging the creative team. Stop over-engineering the software architecture. You are consuming the system's last remaining shreds of margin with your constant panic meddling.
This brings us to the operational definition of an ancient philosophical concept the author integrates, Wu Wei.
Oh, I've heard of that.
In popular culture, Wu Wei is often vastly misunderstood. It's mistranslated as pure passivity, laziness, or literally doing nothing. But in the context of complex systems and quaternary prevention, Wu Wei is defined as action without excess force. It is highly disciplined, deeply aware interaction.
Let me play devil's advocate here. If I'm a manager, and my flagship project is hemorrhaging money and falling behind schedule, and I tell my executive board that I'm practicing Wu Wei by stepping back and minimizing my intervention, I'm going to get fired on the spot. How is this not just an intellectual excuse for managerial negligence?
It's a vital distinction. Negligence is walking away because you don't care or because you're paralyzed by the noise. Wu Wei requires intense, continuous observation. It requires you to map the altimeter signals meticulously.
So you're still highly engaged.
Deeply engaged. The restraint of Wu Wei is not an absence of effort. It is an economy of effort. It means intervening only when absolutely necessary, at exactly the right leverage point, with the minimum amount of force required to guide the system, and then immediately stopping the intervention.
Is martial arts applied to management?
Beautifully said. When prevention is effective and Wu Wei is practiced, the system operates with a fluid ease and flexibility. When it is absent, the system requires escalating brute force just to survive another day.
Okay, this all sounds beautifully philosophical and the theory is tight. But does this actually hold up in the mud and chaos of the real world? The text spends a significant amount of time running this entire framework through three wildly different, incredibly complex real-world stress tests to prove its universal application. Let's dig deep into these, starting with medicine.
The clinical example the author uses is early sepsis. This is a notoriously difficult condition to manage because it involves massive systemic dysregulation.
Right.
Imagine a patient sitting in an intensive care unit. You look at the monitors, their dashboard, their blood pressure is acceptable, their oxygen saturation is fine, the state variables are green. But the embedded clinician who's practicing observation notices an altimeter signal, path dependence.
They're building a tolerance.
Right. The patient's physiological response to standard IV fluids is subtly changing. The same input is yielding a diminishing output. The vascular system is losing its tone.
And the clinician is trapped inside the system. They're constrained. They're on hour 10 of a shift. They have 5 other critically ill patients, and the alarms are constantly pinging. If they fall into the delay trap, what happens?
If they delay, they wait for the standard, rigidly defined protocol to trigger. And the protocol only triggers when the dashboard turns red, when the patient's blood pressure catastrophically crashes. By waiting for certainty, they have allowed the patient's margin to evaporate. The system is now in structural failure.
But if the clinician falls into the fourth trap, out of a desire to proactively control the situation, they might aggressively overtreat early on. They might flood the patient with massive volumes of fluids and high-dose vasopressors to guarantee the numbers stay optimal.
Which sounds like a good thing. They're getting ahead of the crash.
It looks good on the monitor. But that aggressive force causes structural damage. Massive fluid overload damages the lungs and kidneys. High-dose pressors cut off circulation to the extremities. The forceful interventions stabilize the state variables, but deeply damage the patient's physiological architecture.
Exactly. The path of Wu-Wei minimal intervention requires the clinician to navigate the narrow middle path. They recognize the altimeter signal of path dependence early, they increase their monitoring frequency, they adjust fluids carefully in small increments.
They guide it.
Yes. They reassess the body's response continuously. They guide the physiology before the protocol forces them into a corner, preserving the patient's physical margin.
Now let's jump to a completely different domain to see if the rules still apply. Infrastructure. Specifically, the text looks at a massive wastewater treatment plant. A severe storm hits the region, flooding the system with excess flow. The plant is processing the water, and the effluent compliance numbers, the chemical makeup of the water being discharged into the river, are totally green, the regulators are happy, the dashboard is fine.
But the plant operator notices an altimeter signal.
Right. They notice that the biological recovery of the bacteria in the aeration tanks is incredibly slow after the peak flow passes. Another altimeter signal, delayed recovery.
A wastewater plant is essentially a massive, living biological organism. It relies on a delicate balance of bacteria to break down waste. If the operator panics at the delayed recovery, if they succumb to the force failure mode, they might crank up the mechanical aeration to maximum and dump in harsh chemical coagulants to guarantee the effluent numbers stay green for the regulators.
And again, forcing works in the short term. The water leaving the plant is clean, the regulators don't issue a fine.
Yes, but the aggressive over-aeration and the chemical shock deeply traumatize the biological colonies in the tanks. The operator has destroyed the plant's biological buffer. They have created long-term systemic instability and fragility just to buy short-term regulatory compliance.
So next time a storm hits, the plant will fail catastrophically because the margin is gone.
Exactly. Wu-Wei in this context means having the discipline to gradually adjust the load, carefully monitoring the biological buffer, and having the sheer restraint to let the living system stabilize itself naturally without overriding it with mechanical force.
It is genuinely staggering how the exact same patterns of failure and the exact same architectural solutions apply perfectly to a human cardiovascular system and a municipal sewage plant. But let's scale it up to the highest level, economics and governance. The third stress test is an asset bubble in the financial markets.
This is where the distortion field we discussed earlier operates at its absolute maximum power. In an economic boom, the macroeconomic dashboard is spectacular. GDP is soaring, employment is at historic highs, asset prices are climbing. But beneath the glittering surface, leverage is silently, exponentially growing. Debt is compounding. Risky loans are being normalized.
And this is an environment completely dominated by narrative and incentive distortion. Because everyone is making money, the banks, the investors, the politicians taking credit for the economy, absolutely no one has the permission to acknowledge the rising systemic risk. It is a profound state of silence.
Exactly. So how do policymakers react? If they fall into the delay trap, they simply ignore the growing leverage. They buy into the normalized deviance, claiming that, oh, this time is different and the market has reached a permanently high plateau. They wait until the bubble bursts and the credit markets freeze, resulting in a catastrophic global recession.
But if they realize they are behind the curve and panic, they fall into the force trap. They abruptly, violently jack up interest rates in a matter of months, intentionally crashing the market to kill the bubble, causing massive collateral damage, bankrupting businesses, and throwing millions into unemployment.
The alternative, the path of coherence, requires applying primordial prevention years earlier. It means shaping the incentive structures, strictly enforcing lending standards, and building regulatory firewalls long before the bubble ever has a chance to inflate.
And if the bubble is already there?
If the bubble is already forming, it means using Wuwei. Gently adjusting capital constraints, clearly communicating risk to the markets to naturally cool speculative fervor, and slowly deflating the pressure over time without causing a sudden traumatic shock to the structure.
Wow.
Across all three of these wildly different domains, intensive care medicine, civic infrastructure, and global economics, the shared overarching danger is identical. The hidden cost of over-intervention. We believe that more control equals more safety, but the reality is, more control almost always equals more fragility.
So we've gone from the theoretical physics of complex systems down into the mud of hospitals and economies. But what does this all mean for you, the listener, in the context of your daily life? How do we synthesize all of this dense material into an actionable daily philosophy? The document brings it all home with a final overarching concept, the minimal intervention principle.
The minimal intervention principle is the distillation of everything we've discussed. It states, you must act only to the extent necessary to restore or preserve the coherence of the system and absolutely no further.
And no further.
Right. Before you lay a finger on any system, whether it's correcting a subordinate's work, adjusting your investment portfolio, or changing your diet, you must force yourself to answer three deeply uncomfortable questions.
Let's hear them.
One, is this intervention truly structurally necessary, or am I just reacting to the normal, healthy variability of the system? Two, if action is required, what is the absolute least amount of force required to guide the system back to stability? And three, what is the hidden cost of this action to the system's underlying margin and future adaptability?
The text visualizes this as a spectrum of action. It starts at the lowest level of energy, pure observation. Then, if necessary, it moves to adjustment, then to guidance, then to formal intervention. And finally, only as a last resort, to force. And the ultimate goal of a competent leader, clinician, or individual is to stay as far to the left on that spectrum, as low energy as humanly possible.
And committing to that low energy spectrum requires accepting an epistemological reality that human beings hate. You will always be seeing in fragments. You will never, ever have perfect data. You will never possess the complete godlike picture of the system.
You're still in the engine block.
Yeah, exactly. You are an embedded observer with profound constraints. Therefore, you have to learn to hold deep uncertainty without becoming paralyzed by it and without reacting to it with violent force.
I want to speak directly to you, the listener, for a second. Attention is a severely limited biological resource. You only have so much cognitive bandwidth in a day. You cannot monitor every single metric, KPI, and dashboard in your business, your budget, or your body. You have to stop obsessing over the lagging variables. Yes, they are comforting because they give you a hard number, but they're lying to you about the future. Start paying attention to the structural drift, the way things are subtly, quietly changing over time. Think about your own altimeters. Is the exact same amount of effort at work suddenly yielding fewer results? That's path dependence. Is the recovery time after a stressful week getting longer? Does a bad Tuesday ruin your entire weekend now? That is delayed recovery. That is your personal altimeter whispering to you that your margin is almost gone.
This raises an important question, though. If we accept that we are constrained and that our systems distort reality, how do we accept responsibility for outcomes when we fully recognize that we do not have total control over them? The answer is disciplined restraint. Coherence is quiet. It doesn't look like frantic, heroic firefighting.
It doesn't look like an executive pulling all-nighters to force a project over the finish line.
No, it looks like stability without strain. It is the ongoing, continuous, humble practice of participating in a system without crushing it beneath our desire for control.
Let's do a narrative recap of the journey we just went on. We started by learning that the dashboards we trust implicitly are deceiving us because they only show the lagging present, not the structural future. We explored the darker reality that systems actively, intentionally distort the truth. They choose silence over noise to protect themselves from the political and economic costs of awareness.
Right.
We realize that we are not gods standing outside the machine. We are embedded observers trapped inside the hot engine block, subject to our own severe constraints and cognitive blind spots. And we saw how our desperate, well-intentioned instinct to force a fix usually destroys the exact structural margin the system desperately needs to survive.
The answer to this complexity isn't to build a bigger dashboard or exert more aggressive control.
No. The answer is early, minimal, architectural, and reversible action. The answer is Wu Wei.
The entire discipline of relational coherence is fundamentally about making a psychological shift. You have to transition from the comforting illusion of controlling a system from the outside to the rigorous, aware participation within the system from the inside.
So here is my direct challenge to you today. Tomorrow morning, take a hard look at the complex systems in your own life. Look at your team dynamic at work. Look at your personal finances. Look at your physical health and your most important relationships. What is the dashboard telling you is perfectly fine? And what is the altimeter whispering is actually drifting toward failure? Where are you burning margin just to keep up appearances?
It is a profound, irreversible shift in perspective. Once you train your eyes to stop looking at the superficial variables and start looking at the deep structure, you can never look at the world the same way again.
I want to leave you with a final, somewhat provocative thought to chew on. We didn't really touch on the overarching philosophy of modern technology today, but think about this. Our entire modern world, our algorithms, our corporate institutions, our economic policies, and our management philosophies are all aggressively built on the fundamental premise of constantly increasing our objective control. We believe progress means forcing every variable to look optimized and green on a digital dashboard. But based on everything we learned today, are we actually building a resilient, adaptable future? Or are we just creating a massive, highly optimized, incredibly brittle global system that requires an infinite, exhausting amount of human effort just to avoid total collapse? Remember that feeling of betrayal we talked about at the very beginning? The comfort of a clean binary report that says everything is fine, it's a fantasy. Real life is muddy. Real life is profoundly complex. And the sooner we accept that we are trapped inside the engine with the car speeding down the highway, the sooner we can stop trying to force the machine to obey us and start learning how to actually drive.